The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey folks, I challenge you to think of at least one thing you no longer do that you wish you could. Do you miss like playing golf, maybe long walks with your spouse, sleeping through the night? Are you ready to start living without pain? My colleagues and friends, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Mike Gallagher, have been talking about their own successful experience with Relief Factor, and you can add Eric Metaxas to that list. Relief Factor is changing the lives of tens of thousands of Salem radio listeners by reducing and even eliminating daily aches and pains. ReliefFactor.com is full of great success stories, and now I am on board. For just $19.95, Relief Factor is offering a three-week quick start that could help you live your life with little to no pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com to see testimonials from folks all over the country. I love reading them. Over 70% of those that try Relief Factor continue as a customer. Feel the relief and get back your independence and freedom from the aches and pains of everyday life. Go to ReliefFactor.com. Read the testimonies. I tell all my relatives to take it. ReliefFactor.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. It's the show featuring Gogo the Chimp.
Nothing like a chimp to liven up a radio show.
Easy there, Gogo. No! Now your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. Welcome to Hour 2 of the Eric Metaxas Show. This is, of course, another bunker video. We are taping the regular show. We've taped the regular show ahead of time in our glorious TBN studios. Hour one was Mary Eberstadt. Hour two will be the continuation of my conversation with Mary Eberstadt. Actually, very important conversation. Her book is Primal Screams, about leftist rage and other things. But this is a bunker video. So you can see the production values are very, very different. And you can also see that we're all in our bunkers. Chris, are you in your bunker?
I am. Yeah. I'm actually in my teenage daughter's bedroom because my office is busy. So,
because your bunker is occupied.
That's right.
It's so bad. You have to go to bunker number two. Albin, you're in your bunker.
Yeah. Speaking of number two, I'm kind of out. But I do have a Corona miracle. You were talking about Christmas miracles.
Well, okay. Everybody has heard of Christmas miracles. These amazing stories. But you have a COVID-19 Corona miracle that you wanted to share with the group. Go ahead. Yeah. We need encouragement in these times.
Okay, this is serious. About the last day I was at the studio, it was a Wednesday about a month ago. I was coming home, and every couple of weeks I like to buy my wife a dozen red roses or, you know, some beautiful roses there in Grand Central Station. Well, the last chance I had, and I didn't know it was my last chance, I bought her a dozen red roses. This is almost a month ago now, and look at them. Some of them are gone, but most of them are still there. They're still in great shape.
It's a Corona miracle.
Woo!
Incredible. Yeah. You know, Albin, by buying your wife flowers like that, I just want to say you're making all of us other husbands look really bad. And this
that's the reason why I mentioned it, really. It wasn't about the miracle. It was more about shame on you other husbands.
Yeah. You're making us look bad, man. I forget my wife's name. That's how bad it is. But she's wife number five. So what are you going to do? Okay. I've been watching like it's become a habit that Suzanne and I we go either to Amazon Prime or Hulu or Netflix, and we're watching BBC miniseries of 19th century novels. Dickens is amazing. There is so many good Dickens so many good Dickens series out there that the BBC has produced most of them. Jane Austen. Now we're watching, there are two versions of Vanity Fair. William Makepeace Thackeray takes place around 1815. But it's amazing drama. If you're looking for something to watch on quote-unquote TV, there is a ton of great stuff. There's some Shakespeare adaptations, a lot of amazing stuff. And I just want to encourage people during these crazy times, since you can't get out of the house, you know, maybe check out some classic literature that's been turned into you know, great drama. And of course, you can read the books themselves, but, you know, if you want to save time. So, Albin, you were going to share, this is really an official SADAR's radar segment right now. So, Albin.
Yes.
Albin SADAR. Tell us, SADAR's radar, what do you got?
SADAR's radar. These are things that are on my radar. Okay, I've been scouring the web and I've been talking to people and I found some good news reports about what's happening with the coronavirus. And this actually is good news. This is an effect that people are actually, in many cases, are being nicer to each other. This is real. CEOs across the country, you know, these multimillionaires are giving up their salary for the year so that they can help out their regular workers, which is a good idea once, you know, some of these workers are being laid off and they're going to have to come back after a while. Now, if you're not sure if your CEO, your multimillionaire boss is donating his yearly salary, you know, give him a call and ask him to, you know, spill some gravy your way. Because if
that's very funny, spill some gravy your way. You get high points for that, my friend. You know, before we go further here, I have to comment and say that this is what America is all about. Our economy will go totally down the tubes unless people do things like this. But in a free market economy like this, there are people with wealth who actually care about their workers and who can do things. And this kind of stuff goes such a long way. I don't just mean in terms of keeping the economy going, but in terms of what it means to someone when they know that the leader of their company has foregone something he certainly did not legally need to forego, because we don't live in a socialist culture where a society or government where the government insists on taking away money and redistributing it. So when people actually do it, it means that much more. That's actually kind of amazing, Albin. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah,
what else?
A neighbor here in the condo community where we live, we were talking to her and she said, look, I couldn't get my the woman that cleans my condo to come in and work for me because I'm afraid that I might give it to her or she might give it to me. But I sent her a check anyway because I don't want her to suffer financially because I can't have her into my apartment. So in little ways, people are helping out as well. And I think that's really incredible. Now, Hanes Underwear, you know, the Hanes Underwear Company, and this is real too, they have stopped making the underwear, I guess, but they're now making face masks because face masks are needed for surgeons, et cetera.
There's something a little gross about this. Can you explain?
Yeah, they make clothing and they have cloth, so they're going to make the surgical mask, the mask that you need. But they said in the meantime, if you don't get a mask, you could always just wear your underwear on your head.
I have an uncomfortable story that I think I need to tell right now. When I was in junior high school, I was very young. I skipped a grade and I didn't mature physically until about a year ago, and so. I would be down in the locker room during gym period and there'd be these like big guys who looked like they just got out of prison and, you know, they were on the football team or whatever. And there was a thing that they would do to the weaker, younger people. They never got me, thank God. But they would take their jock, their athletic supporter, and they'd sneak up behind an unsuspecting person, snap it over his face like an oxygen mask. And they would then say, in the tones of a medical professional, they would say, administering joxygen.
TMI.
It was a horrible, horrible thing. And I never wanted to mention it on the air, but you just forced me to.
You just did it. Yeah. One last thing. We were talking again to the same neighbor, and she said that she's going into the way back in her freezer now and grabbing things that she put in there a year or two ago. So, and Ann and I are doing the same thing. In fact, we grabbed some fish that we had put into the freezer about 20 years ago. And about 15 years ago, it was on the endangered species list. In fact, it was declared extinct. So now we're eating classic food from our freezer.
Classic food. That's very funny, Albin. That's very funny. And I'm not just saying that.
Classic
food. I just want to remind people that one of our main sponsors is Relief Factor, and I take it every day. Now, the reason I take it every day is because I need to take it every day because it actually works. But I have this advantage. Suzanne, when she takes pills, you know, she has a feminine-sized esophagus, so it takes her forever to take pills. But like I can take 3 packets of Relief Factor, like nothing, like in seconds, you know, I pour the 12. By the way, I also should say that I drink out of an Honor Bound coffee mug because yeah. Honor Bound is also a sponsor of the program. But I take like all these pills. Can we see these pills? We can't really. But
Wow. There you go.
It's like Evel Knievel. Yeah. Wow, it's like Evel Knievel.
Wash it down with Honor Bound coffee. Ann and I love it too. Honor Bound coffee. My goodness.
Done.
There you go.
That's all you, need
we're
to
getting
do.
A new shipment delivered to our door, by the way. Honor Bound coffee. It comes every month. We just love it. You sign up for it. Mention that Eric Metaxas sent you. It's great.
You know, in all seriousness, darn it, we're out of time. Well, look, these bunker videos, we're going to do them every day. I want to encourage everyone listening, please share these with your friends. Please share these with your friends. Please tell them to go to honorboundcoffee.com. Every bit of profit that they make goes to help military families. That is true. They're the people behind Relief Factor. I also want to say that our guest, Mary Eberstadt, we've got a whole hour with her coming up. This is hour two with her. The book is Primal Screams. I think we're out of time right now. Guys, God
bless you. Food for the poor, folks. Food for the poor, folks. Make sure you donate.
Don't forget food for the poor. MetaxasTalk.com. Please. Thank you.
Someone's knocking at the door. Somebody's ringing the bell. Do me a favor. Open the door.
Sipping whiskey from a paper cup. You drown your sorrows till you can't stand up. And take a look at what you've done to yourself. Why don't you? You put the bottle back on the shelf. Yellow fingered from your cigarettes. Your hands are shaking while your body sweats. Why don't you look into Jesus? He got the answer.
Hey there, folks. It's Eric Metaxas Show. I'm continuing my conversation with Mary Eberstadt. The new book is called Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. But Mary, before we continue, I just want to say that you're the author of many spectacular books. We talked last year, I think, about your book, How the West Really Lost God, A New Theory of Secularization. You also have a book, Adam and Eve After the Pill, Paradoxes of the Sexual Revolution. And then It's Dangerous to Believe, Religious Freedom and Its Enemies. All of these are subjects of real fascination and interest to me. You've written a lot about the sexual revolution. You seem to have seen pretty early on that it was not a good thing for anyone.
Well, I want to be clear that I'm not advancing a monocausal argument. There's a lot else going on that contributes what I would call accelerants to our national plight.
Sure.
The loss of manufacturing jobs, the internet, globalization, et cetera. But even the internet in all its power, I think, is not fundamentally what has transformed us as a society. The reason I think that is that identity politics predates the internet. Again, we're going back to 1977. And why is that important? Because this is as the first generation is coming of age in the sexual revolution. So I don't think these two things can be disentangled. One, the fracturing of the normal situation in which you find an identity, and two, the flight and rising power of these collective political identities.
Well, in your book on Adam and Eve After the Pill, you touch on something that I wanted to bring up. I mean, it seems to me that when the pill was invented in 1961, roughly, it changed everything because it made it possible for people to ignore what no one had ignored since the beginning of time, the idea that sex leads to babies and families and marriage, and that if you want to have sex, you're going to have to figure out a way to either get married or to do some weird end run around it that's going to be frowned on by most of the culture. The pill changed that.
How could it not? How could it not? I think it was the most consequential thing that has happened to mankind since Eve took the apple in the garden. Now, to say that is not to say it was well understood at the time how the world would change after this technological revolution. A lot of people thought that the pill would make life better. The argument was made that it would strengthen marriage. the argument was made that it would reduce abortions. Margaret Sanger made that argument, as a matter of fact. We now know in retrospect what people of the time couldn't know. The pill is introduced, and then fatherlessness, abortion, broken homes, all of these behaviors skyrocket simultaneously. And that is what has so changed the world that we live in. In my books, what I'm trying to do piece by piece is understand the actual fallout of what happened in the 1960s, as opposed to the happy talk that is part of the dominant culture.
Well, this happy talk assumes that everybody's going to be sexually active. And if you don't realistically, quote unquote, accept that, something's wrong with you. You have a Pollyanna view. And I think that's so hopeless and so sad. I mean, the idea that people cannot choose to say no to sexual activity, that, oh, my goodness, we're all so weak and it's just going to happen and we've got to give our kids pills to take because we all know, wink, wink, they're probably going to be sexually active. It's one of those weird things. It's like saying, listen, your kids are going to do drugs. You may as well give them the drugs and have them do it in your basement so you can kind of keep an eye on it. It's so cynical and so broken. But that's, to me, what happened to the culture via the pill.
Another way of putting that, Eric, is that we are living in a time dominated by false anthropology. This is something else I'm trying to get across in my work. By that, I mean that we are dominated by a crabbed and diminutive understanding of human nature. As you just indicated, the notion that we can't have self-mastery, for example, over various impulses in our lives is a low estimation of human potential and human nature. So what I'm trying to do in this work is push back against this powerful, dominant worldview according to which we, men and women, are smaller and more helpless creatures than we actually are.
Well, that's interesting, because I do think that is the case, that the rise of the gay rights movement comes out of that as well. In other words, if you become a hypersexualized culture where no one is saying no to sexual activity, then somebody who has a same-sex inclination says, well, what about me? Why should I say no? In the past, when you had lots of people eschewing sexual activity, saying, you know what, I didn't get married and that's not going to be part of my life. I'm going to be a bachelor, or I'm going to live with my sister, a woman living with her sister. And they're perfectly happy being, what we used to call spinsters. And there was a place in the culture for people who weren't sexualized, whether a nun or a priest or something. Something happened in the 50s with Kinsey that introduced a very cynical view that said, come on, this is nonsense. Everybody is doing something. They're not just talking about it. And his research, which was largely garbage, was disseminated to the whole West and taken as gospel truth. And it wasn't debunked till about 30 years later. And people bought into that idea. And then everybody said, well, if everybody else is having fun in that way, then why shouldn't I? The very idea that you could live a life fulfilled without that was effectively taken off the table.
Very much so. And again, we have to ask here, who was empowered by this? What kind of bad actors might have seen in this sexualization of the culture an opportunity for doing exactly what they wanted to do? Now, again, I think we see this in the Me Too movement. We see opportunistic men allegedly acting in this serial predatory way.
Right.
This also goes back to the pill, because the only thing that makes predation possible on that scale is that those men had the assumption that women were sexually available without consequence to them, right?
Right.
Because if women were sexually available with consequences to follow, all those men would be in court paying child support.
Yeah.
But instead, it's the assumption that women are everywhere and always available without consequence.
Well, and obviously abortion follows from that. And I think that the dirty little secret of abortion is that it's pushed by men, because they are the ones who can say, for a couple hundred bucks, if something bad happens, hey, we can take care of it. And it was foisted on women as an empowering thing, when the reality is that if men were behaving the way they should behave, women would never have to make this horrific choice. It wouldn't face them.
Well, as a historical matter, before abortion was legalized, one of its main proponents in the United States was, of course, Hugh Hefner. Abortion was the necessary backup to the Playboy philosophy.
Right. And then when the pill was invented, you know, they could push that. I have a friend who was, I think, the first class of women at Yale. And she said the sexual pressure on them that they were being given pills by the, you know, by the nurses and stuff. It was like as they came in, they were sort of pushed in this direction as though this was expected of them. Now you're here. This is what you're going to do. And it created all kinds of social pressure for women who didn't want that. But I really do think that is the story. It's the dirty little secret of the sexual revolution.
Well, the dirty little secret is that it's coercive, that it empowered the already strong and it weakened the already weaker.
Well, it's just so extraordinary that one of the reasons it's wonderful to have you on, Mary, is that people don't normally talk about this. You're not hearing this narrative. You know, this is not the thing that Charlie Rose would have invited you on to talk about, or so many others that have talk shows. They sort of avoid this stuff because we are, you know, kicking against these cultural giants that have grown up in the 50 or 60 years.
I would like to address that briefly, Eric, because we hear this all the time, that conservatives are addicted to a narrative of decline, you know, this kind of thing. Well, what if there really is a decline? I can think of a number of measures suggesting that we're seeing real decline. The rise in loneliness, already mentioned. The rise in psychiatric problems among the young. Can we talk about that? The rise in suicide rates among the young. And I don't put these thoughts out there to be a Debbie Downer. I put them out there because these things are intrinsically problematic and wrong. They are indicative of human suffering on a scale that we're not accustomed to. So we'd better understand where they're coming from.
We're going to go to another break. When we come back, we'll continue that line of thinking. Folks, I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. The book is Primal Screams.
Shoe shine boy, and I thought I was gonna jump with joy. Slapped on a shoe polish left and right. He took his shoe shine rag and he held it tight. He stopped once.
I know I stand in line until you think you have the time to spend an evening with me. And if we go someplace to dance, I know that there's a chance you won't be leaving with me.
Oh, hello. That's the chairman of the board. I'm Eric Metaxas, and I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. The new book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Now, Mary, you were talking about how, you know, a lot of times people accuse conservatives of, you know, being downers. And the fact of the matter is sometimes, unfortunately, there are ugly things happening, and it's healthy to face them, to acknowledge them. That's what you're doing. I think there are many people listening who understand that there's nothing hyperbolic about what you're saying. These are sad but true things. So I guess the question is, how would you see a way out of this? Do you think – I guess my hope is that things have gotten so bad in so many ways that people are finally beginning to see the horror of the sexual revolution.
So it's like any other malady, right? We need to get the diagnosis right before we can move forward. And that's what I'm trying to do in Primal Screams. There are a lot of competing diagnoses out there. On the left, there are people who think the reason for their misery is the patriarchy or the gender binary or other abstractions like this. As long as we think those things are the problem, we're not going to fix anything. So I think it's a little bit like the example of tobacco smoking. We have to keep hammering away at the public health problems that are resulting from this widespread acceptance of a substance, if you want to use that analogy. What can be done down the road if we can have a little consciousness raising? I think one thing that's imperative is that some people on the left have to come forward with the courage to say that they part company with the dominant thinking out there, and they acknowledge the sexual revolution as a problem. And that's what hasn't happened in a long time. It used to be the thinker Christopher Lash, who described himself as a man of the left, was insistent on this point, on the importance of family as a ballast against the state and just intrinsically in its own right. And he used to speak to against feminist attacks on the family, for example. There's no one in intellectual life who does what Christopher Lash did. Similarly, there used to be feminists who were courageous enough to say, there's a problem with pornography. Pornography demeans women, diminishes them. There's almost no one I can think of who will take that position today. So what we need first and foremost is for people to break out of the monolithic left and be the leaders that we need to make common cause with those of us who agree to this diagnosis.
I guess I feel like we are seeing that. In other words, I think that it all depends where you live, because, you know, if you live in the academy or if you live among the cultural elites, you'll see it less. But I think in the what I think of as the real world, you do see these crack ups. I think that you do see more people being willing to say that porn is the problem and that people on the left and the right can agree that it's a problem. I mean, it has to go a long ways before everybody sees it, but it's gone a long ways and it's creating all kinds of problems. Obviously, Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the 60s was willing to talk about how important the family is. And I think that those of us who see these things probably need to be much bolder about it. I think a lot of times we forget that there are many people that would nod if they hear you say this. They go, you know what? You're right. I see this. And I do. I go around the country and I do a lot of speaking. I see a lot of health. I see a lot of big families teaching their kids the right things. And I just go, holy cow, these folks are going to take over the world, because they get it. It doesn't matter, you know, what you're reading in The Atlantic or The New Yorker or whatever it is. The people out there, they get it and they've seen it. But I guess, you know, it really does depend on how the messages get out there. I was, you know, mentioning Charlie Rose earlier. There aren't a lot of places in the mainstream culture to get these messages out. It's one of the reasons I do this show. I think to myself, it doesn't get more important than this conversation, but who is talking about this? Who has the guts to talk about this? Fox News is obsessed with politics. They're not going to have you on for a long conversation about this. Maybe that's too depressing for them or something. And, you know, we need to, you know, punch, you know, a Democrat in the face every 45 seconds. Otherwise, people will turn the channel. And I kind of feel like that to me is the bigger problem, is getting the message out, because I think it would resonate when people hear it.
Well, again, my hope is that pointing to the misery that this new world order has created will resonate with some people. And it's not all social science. There are several pages in the book where I summarize what's been going on in popular music. And I list a long list of bands, beginning with Eminem, who made it their signature to sing about and rap about divorce and the broken families that they came from, and fatherlessness, and on and on. And you can see in these songs that even as of the 90s, a lot of young America was cratering over this question of who am I, who do I belong to, who's got my back. So I think going at the argument that way holds out the hope that there are people who will say, that is my life, and that is right, and my problem actually isn't the gender binary, and my problem actually isn't white nationalism. I'm not saying white nationalism isn't a problem. I'm saying that it doesn't explain
the society. I'm saying it's not a problem.
The society we find ourselves in. So it's that hope of recognition and the hope that it brings us secular converts so that we can have a civil conversation about where to go from here, how to build a more family-friendly America, for instance.
We'll be right back talking to Mary Eberstadt. Don't go away.
Yeah.
Hey there, folks. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. The book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Mary, I want to ask you about the Me Too movement. It struck me, and this is where I see hope in all this, is that there are sides, different sides of these crazy fractured groups that are beginning to bump into each other. And the Me Too movement was a healthy example of that. It can always go too far, and it has gone too far in some ways. But the idea that men are behaving like total pigs, and that this has been the way it's been since the beginning of time, and suddenly somebody's saying, hey, wait a minute, this is wrong. Now, anybody with any integrity knows it's wrong, and if anybody I knew behaved that way, I'd kill him. Like, you know, how dare you do this to a young woman? Or, you know, like you just say that most people that I hang out with know that that's sick behavior. But I've also known that in corporate America and in Hollywood, that's the way everybody flies. And the idea that finally somebody's saying, excuse me, this is wrong, it's a sign of health.
I agree with that. I think the Me Too movement presents us with a moment when we might be able to reach across the divide. Now, there are great ironies in this Me Too movement. Where did these stories come from? They came from the corridors that are supposedly the most enlightened, right, our sophisticated betters in Hollywood.
But that proves our point.
In the media. Well, you know, Eric, I have to say the Me Too movement is one of the things that gave me the idea for this book, because I read through hundreds of these horrible accounts by young women. First of all, most of them sophisticated products of elite education. All the better universities and the better schools were represented in these stories. And yet somehow these young women had never learned basic lessons in life. Don't go to your boss's hotel room at 1 a.m. being an example. So I started scratching my head and thinking, how did they not know that? Simultaneously, I noticed something else. In all of these horrible stories, these alleged things that these men did to these younger women, there is almost no mention by these women of a father, a brother, a cousin, yep, any male playing a protective, yep, role. And so I thought, huh, how could that be? Did no one ever go to a male relative for redress? And then it struck me, a lot of them don't have people in those categories.
Or I would argue that they have been trained in these elite cultural institutions like Yale not to go to them, because they say, what? I'm not, you know, a chattel slave that I belong to my father until I'm sold to my husband. I'm my own person. And you think, yeah, you're your own person, but God has instituted a kind of order to protect you, because the opposite of toxic masculinity is good masculinity that says, I want to protect everyone around me who might be vulnerable. I want to protect my daughter, my wife, my niece, whatever, that I will be there. But if something in the culture says, no, leave me alone, I'm my own woman, I don't need help from a man, you don't need to open the door for me, you don't need to protect me. A lot of these women have foolishly put themselves in vulnerable positions because they really believe that's the thing to do.
Yes, that brings me straight to a chapter in the book about feminism, because I have what I think is a contrarian reading of it. Feminism is the oldest of the political identities in the modern identity politics sense. And as we've seen, it's gotten increasingly belligerent over time. The language is aggressive. There are many examples in the book, and we see this kind of swagger and this bellicosity, this masculinization, frankly. I don't think feminism is well understood at all. I don't think feminism is about all of these women who are, you know, riding a victorious wave. First of all, they don't look happy about anything. I think feminism is a kind of protective coloration that a lot of women have put on after the sexual revolution. They're responding to the very real fact that there are more predators, there are more likely harmful things that are going to come their way, and they're exaggerating these masculine characteristics because, again, there is a dearth of masculine protective figures in their lives.
Well, and that's the issue, isn't it, is that if you mess with God's order, I will go out on a limb and say it's God's order, you force women to become more manly. you force men to become more feminine. There's something that happens, you know, and it's not good for anyone. I think the idea that feminism, if anything, if there's anything good in it, it would make women more themselves, not more like men. But I think it has made them more like men, having to protect themselves and having to be tougher. And they keep talking about women's empowerment. And you think, well, where'd you get the idea that this was such a beautiful thing? What's your worldview?
And I think it's also had the parallel effect of feminizing men.
Yeah.
Men get very confusing signals from the dominant culture out there.
Yeah.
And in a world where half of them are growing up without fathers in the house, where the sole authority figure is a female authority figure,
yeah,
there are all kinds of reasons to lean in toward the feminine side that didn't exist before.
Right. It's interesting. We had a guest on this program, Bobby Lopez, one of the most fascinating guests I've ever had. He grew up in a home without a father. His mother married another woman, and so he had all of this feminist kind of influence around him. He was sexually abused at a young age by another man and slipped into the gay lifestyle. And what's interesting to me is that at rock bottom, he reconnects with his own father and almost instantly becomes the man. I should say not instantly, but it starts instantly, and he becomes more and more able to be the man that is. There was something magical about being with his father who cared for him and so on and so forth. And I think that this is the kind of thing that's denigrated in the culture. The role of fathers, you know, has been denigrated since the sexual revolution. And there's something really sick about that. And we have to acknowledge that men and women are both created in God's image. And to denigrate one of them is to denigrate both and to denigrate God himself. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt, the website, maryeberstadt.com. The new book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. In the sunshine, where the days are longer, the nights are stronger than moonshine. There's talk on the street. Hey there, folks. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. There's so many books, Mary, that you have written. I hope my audience will get their appetites whetted by this conversation to read the new book, Primal Screams, and to read your other books. At the heart of everything, because we're both Christians, it seems to me that Solzhenitsyn kind of summed it up when he said, he was quoting a Russian proverb, as he sometimes did. He said, we've gotten to where we are because men have forgotten God. God has an order, and if he loves us, that order is meant to bless us. And it does seem to me that something happened in the 20th century via the sexual revolution where we moved away from some basics, and it has been hurting us ever since.
And it's a chicken and egg situation very much, and I write about this in How the West Really Lost God. Because I don't think secularization is well understood. I don't think the decline in church going is well understood. It's not because we've gotten smarter than our ancestors were. It's not because we're more sophisticated or in possession of a better secular ideology. It's because the sexual revolution, for many people, disrupted the home, which is the transmission belt of religious learning, and it also took fathers out of the picture. And you know, in Christianity, it's God the Father. So we have people who don't know what a benevolent father on this earth looks like. And of course they're going to find the idea of a benevolent father in heaven harder to grasp. I'm not saying it's impossible. Evangelization is always possible. What I'm saying is these things are related. There is a crisis of the filial that comes in beginning in the 1960s. It is characteristic of our age. It did not exist before. And that's what is put in front of us to try and understand and change.
Well, the Bible, God commands us to honor our mothers and our fathers. And I don't care if your father's not a great guy. The Bible commands you to honor him. And I think that these are the kinds of things that are no longer in the culture. You hear about my father this, my father that. It's like, well, here's the issue. He's your father. And so his behavior, you know, unless it's so abusive you can't go near him, but the idea of honoring him is something that can't fail. There's no way. You will bless yourself if you honor your mother and your father, whether that means just a phone call or to make some effort on a holiday to reach out and to honor that person. It's foundational, basically. And we have kind of, the culture has kind of wiped that away. Honoring the elderly, honoring our parents. Those are the kinds of things that were once baked in, and they've gone away.
And something else that was also baked in by Christianity is the idea of forgiveness.
Mm.
Forgiving those who transgress against you. If you're a Christian, this is drummed into your head. And many people no longer think of that as the first go-to in a situation where they've been wronged, because they haven't been brought up with that transformative idea. And that's why what we see in identity politics is this anger that where the idea of forgiveness is nowhere near.
It's a rage unto death. It can never lead anywhere. It'll just lead you, you know, off the cliff. And it's a hard thing to understand. How do I forgive somebody who's wronged me terribly? It doesn't mean you say what they did is no big deal. Let's make up. No. When Jesus died for us on the cross, it was because of the horror of our sins that he had to die on the cross and that he forgave us. That's something that's not widely understood. Mary, I'm glad you don't live in Timbuktu. You can come back. I hope you will come back. The book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. And Mary Eberstadt, thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks for having me on, Eric. Love to come back.